Welcome to tonight's forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. This evening's talk by economist Richard Wolff was recorded at a KKFI fundraising event back in March. This is the first part of a three-part series where we will cover Wolff's entire speech. Wolff is a longtime economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and is currently at the New School. He hosts a weekly radio show, Economic Update, and his efforts to promote workers' co-ops through the Democracy at Work project have made him a leading voice for alternatives to today's grossly unequal economy, where, according to the New York Times, the richest 1% in the United States now own more wealth than the bottom 90%. His most recent book is Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. Thanks for tuning in. We begin as Judy Ansel introduces our speaker.
Hi, my name's Judy Ansel. I love KKFI. I've been involved in KKFI for decades, and I love our listeners. And thank you so much, all of you, for coming. I want to also thank Joe Avila, sitting in back, who you met in the beginning, for the Carpenter's donation of this hall for us to use. It's a wonderful hall, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you should see their training center in the back. It's amazing how they are training young carpenters to build our buildings and do it with just wages and just benefits. And it's something to be seen. So I'm here to introduce our speaker, Richard Wolff. He went to every major university you can think of, Stanford, Harvard, Yale, but I think, you know, like the major part of his career, 35 years, he spent at the University of Massachusetts Amherst building and then carrying out a really distinctive economics program there, where I'm told he actually insisted that they put it in writing that he was allowed to teach Marxist economics. And this at a time when economics was going completely right-wing with the influence of the University of Chicago School of Economics, which was taking over economics departments and teaching young economists that the free market was the only way to go. And, you know, we owe a lot to folks like Rick Wolff and other heterodox and Marxist economists in the country for keeping alive the truth about what economics really can be. So he retired from UMass Amherst in 2008 and of course couldn't stop teaching. He's now teaching at the New School in New York, lives in New York City, but is a dynamo as far as traveling all over the country and doing speeches like the one you're going to hear tonight, but also running an organization called Democracy at Work. Check out their webpage. It's all about democracy at work. It's all about worker cooperatives. It's all about us taking control of the workplace. And that's an idea whose time has come, even though some of our political leaders don't know it yet. He also writes for the Monthly Review, and he has a radio show. Of course, it's called Economic Update, and I don't know why it's not regularly on KKFI. And any of you out there who are on our programming committee, please become an advocate for getting Economic Update on the air on KKFI. But if it isn't, you can get its podcast. I'm a regular listener to the podcast, and it'll keep you up on lots of interesting things that are going on in the economy and analysis of what's wrong with what you're hearing from most of our politicians in Washington, D.C. So with that, I want to introduce Rick Wolff. Enjoy the talk.
Thank you all for coming. Can you all hear what I'm saying? Good. I want to thank the Carpenters Union for making this space available to us. It makes me feel very, very good to see a cooperation between a community radio station and a trade union. That's something that once existed in the United States, alliances between labor unions and many other community groups because they recognized that each of them would be stronger through the alliance with the other one. And if we're relearning that lesson now, it's very good for us. And I could not be happier if I can help develop that kind of solidarity once again. All right, my job is to talk to you a little bit about the economic situation we face, why it is the way it is, where it's going, and what it means to you. But before I jump into that, two things. First, a request. Some of the things I'm about to explain to you are going to get you upset. I want you to remember that I'm just the messenger. I didn't cause the things I'm going to describe to you. And so I'm urging you to remember that it is not appropriate to shoot the messenger just because you don't like the message. Okay? The second thing is actually to begin by telling you what I did last night. Last night I spoke at a place called Truman State University, about 3 hours north of here in Kirksville, small town in a county that went overwhelmingly for Mr. Trump. They have a speaker series. They invited me to come there. The auditorium they selected holds about 240 people, and 250 came. There were no seats left. The people were standing around. About 250, 255 folks came. The overwhelming majority of them, I would say, were between 18 and 25 years of age. And they were there because they are upset about what is happening in their lives and those of their families. They can't afford the cost of the school. They can't handle the debts. They're frightened about the jobs. They're frightened about the incomes. They're frightened about a lot. Most of them had never heard of me. They weren't there because of me or my performance skills, which I will try to demonstrate to you in a few minutes. They came because they are upset. And the mood in the auditorium was electric. I had what I am having more and more of and that I want to tell you about before I jump into tonight's story. I had an evening that left me with more, not less energy than I began with. Meetings like that are energizing. You come away with reserves of energy you didn't know you had because the mood was so good. These are young people who are determined to change the country, who are not trying simply to solve their problem by finding their own personal escape way. I'll take this course. I'll major in that subject. I'll transfer to over here. No, no, no. They understood that it's kind of too late for that, that to save their situation, they're going to have to change the society and the way it works. 250 people in Kirksville, Missouri, felt that way. You multiply that by all the other Kirksvilles in this country, and we win. We will win. And that's already a reality. I make about 2 trips a month. I can't do more. I'm too busy. I have too many other things to do. Last month, I made a trip to California, where I go often. I spoke in the First Presbyterian Church of Berkeley, California. It's like one of those mega churches. It holds about 700 people in a huge auditorium. And they are a fundraiser for a local public radio station called KPFA. It's a Pacifica station. Every seat was taken in that place. They sold tickets for $20 a person. And it was like a pep rally. I thought about halfway through I'd stop explaining things and I'd just get out pom-poms and jump up and down. Because people were so determined to do something, it was, again, electric. 4 days later, I went north of San Francisco to a place called Rohnert Park. Some of you may have heard of it. It is the home of a place called the Sonoma State University, part of the California state system. There I was, the resident scholar, at the invitation of the president of the university with whom I had dinner before my talk. When I discussed with them before I came what they would like me to speak to the public university-sponsored talk I gave in the evening, this is last month, the president of the university said to me, "We would like you to present a criticism of capitalism." You can't make this up. I didn't suggest it, they did. So when I came to their campus and did precisely that, I didn't have to worry for one second because I was doing what they asked me to do. America is changing in fast and fundamental ways. You may read about the Tea Party and Trump and all of the rest because they get the publicity, they're well connected to get it. But stuff is happening at the other end of the spectrum as fast and as profound as anything happening on the right. You will not hear about it unless people like me who are caught up in it tell you about it, which is why I am doing that now. My last talk on the trip to California was at a place called Berkeley City College, a working class institution that people go to when they have a moment out of their job or at the end of the day to get accredited in credits and so on. The kind of places I really like to go and speak. And that auditorium had about 200 people in it. Again, mostly students, but some faculty and some community people. A few months ago, I was the scholar in residence at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. Same story. The same story. A few months before that, I did a fundraiser for WMNF. It is a very powerful public radio system that serves Tampa, St. Petersburg, and Sarasota, Clearwater, Florida. It is the biggest audience for my radio show, which is now broadcast every week on 75 stations across the United States. Why am I telling you this? Because something is changing in the United States, big time. And I want you to know it so that you don't feel as isolated, as surrounded by people who don't agree with you, as you already do. That is the reasonable result of the last 50 years of this country, where you were made to feel weird, strange, isolated, odd for having the views you do. And it was right for us to say we can't do very much in a society that demonizes us in this way. But that is not the case anymore. If we don't act now, we will have missed a window of opportunity for folks like us that hasn't been here for half a century, and I don't know how long it will last. But if we don't act now, it's on us, because we can. I am a critic of capitalism. I don't like it, I don't think it works real well, and I think the human race can do a lot better. Is that clear? Yeah, good. And wherever I go and I explain that, I get warm, enthusiastic receptions, just like I did from the 255 people in Kirksville, Missouri last night. You are not alone, you are not isolated, you are not small. And if you feel that way, you're doing the work of the people who want us not to succeed. Don't let them color your perception. And for those of you that are older like me, remember, it wasn't this way before the post-World War II period, and therefore it doesn't have to continue, and it is in fact disappearing. Occupy Wall Street was a major step in getting us to this. Bernie Sanders' campaign was a major step in getting us to this. The story I just told you about what's happening to me is another little step in this process. You can be making the difference in the things you do. So as a person who's one of you, I'm pleading with you. Get going, do things, get together, make organizations, figure out your own ways to move this country forward. It's possible now. It would be a shame for us and our children not to do it. And it's possible now. Okay, Let me turn then to the economics of the situation we are in. I meet on a regular basis with pretty famous economists because I went to the right schools. And for those of you who haven't figured this out yet, let me remind you. In our country, it is not what you know, it is who you know. And if you haven't figured that out yet, you will. I promise. So because I went to Harvard, Stanford, and Yale, I know all the right people. My classmate at Yale when I got my PhD degree was a woman, and there were very few women in those days. The woman sitting on my left was a woman named Janet Yellen, who's the head of the Federal Reserve. All right? You become part of an old boy network if you go to these kinds of schools, and so I am. And I meet with some of my friends in New York City who are hedge fund managers or bankers or whatever. And we don't agree how the country got into this mess, and we don't agree how the country should get out. But we actually discovered over the last couple of years that we do agree on something, which we were all surprised about. Here's what we agree on. The United States economy is in the worst condition that we have ever seen, any of us, in our lifetimes. That's the assessment right now. And these include very conservative, very left-wing, and all shades in between of perceptions. So when you hear that we are engaged in an economy that is recovering, you are listening to the wrong program. You are listening to the kind of program which, if I upset you today, you should return to in the evening TV news and you will no longer be bothered. In a world of recovery, and it's all a mirage. There is nothing like that. Capitalism, global capitalism, collapsed in the last 4 months of 2008. In those months, there were hysterical meetings in New York City among bankers, Federal Reserve officials, and a whole host of others, desperate to try to figure out how to stop the disintegration of the American economy, which was understood to mean not just the banks fall apart, which they did, not just the insurance industry dissolve, which it did, but that the regular day-to-day life would stop. The milk wouldn't be delivered, the eggs wouldn't be delivered, the buses wouldn't run, the trains would stop, that kind of a breakdown. We were that close. That kind of a collapse was never supposed to happen. We were supposed to have learned from the great crash of the 1930s how to make sure that didn't happen again. We had learned monetary policy and fiscal policy and what the Federal Reserve should do and what the government should do in deficit spending and all of these wonderful tools which would not give us this crash again. Every president, starting with Franklin Roosevelt, made the same promise. If you do what I propose to be done, not only will I get you out of the current economic downturn, but I will make sure by these policies that we never have such a downturn again. Every president promised it. No president ever delivered it. The promise was false. And the proof of it was the collapse of 2008. But for those of you that like statistics, between the end of the Great Depression in 1941 and the beginning of the crash of 2008, we had 11 more economic downturns. Capitalism has a downturn every 4 to 7 years. Wherever it exists, and it always has. For those of you who've heard the following joke, bear with me. If you lived with a roommate as unstable as capitalism, you would have moved out long ago. And you should wonder why you stay with an economic system that works like this. Every 4 to 7 years, millions lose their jobs. People lose their homes. Careers are interrupted. School educational processes are interrupted. Debts are increased. Why do we do this to ourselves? Why do we permit such an economic system that is so fundamentally unstable? And you know, capitalists have tried to fix that. They've tried to come up with plans and procedures. That's why every president promised it, to prevent it, to stop it, to limit it. There's a whole school of economics that's taught in places like, UMKC. It's called Keynesian economics, after Lord John Keynes in England, who developed this theory in the 1930s of how the government could and should intervene to make sure we don't have crises. very sophisticated, good professors. They teach it all. It just doesn't work, which is why we had a crash in 2008. We can't control this system's instability, which you would think in a rational population ought to make people say, if there's a system that has an awful quality that hurts us and we don't want, maybe we should think about, get ready, another system. Maybe we should change it. Maybe. So it crashed in 2008. And what was the thing that was done? It's amazing if you go over it. The banks and big businesses who had made a regular, enjoyable activity of explaining to the American people, you and me, how private enterprise is the engine of progress and how the government is a fat, overloaded, inefficient, private is good and public. What happened in the autumn of 2008? All those people sang a new song. They all rushed to Washington begging the government that they had denounced to save them from extinction. Let's go over. Every single major money center bank, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, were bankrupt. They could not function. They could not function. The largest automobile company in this country could not function, General Motors. The largest insurance company in the United States and indeed in the world, AIG Corporation, could not function. The government bailed them all out, saved them from collapse. Oh yes, they thought for a while they wouldn't have to. So they let one of them die, called Lehman Brothers. They let it go. And the effect of that was so terrifying that they bailed every other one out right afterwards. They took a lot of, ready? Your money to bail them out. So on behalf of all these banks and big companies, I want to be the first to say to all of you, thank you. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for bailing us out after we've explained that you, the public, the government, are inefficient crumble bums who we barely tolerate. We private efficient enterprises. They weren't private. I'll take that back. They were private. They weren't efficient. They weren't successful. They were disasters. We bailed them out. Federal Reserve loaned these banks trillions. The U.S. Treasury bought shares of stock, special kinds of shares of stock in the banks. Wonderful shares of stock. They're called non-voting stock. Here's how it works. The bank gives you a very low value piece of paper. And the Treasury buys the piece of paper, it's a share of stock, for $50 a share. It's non-voting stock. So the government gets to give money to the bank for the share, but the government has no vote over what the bank does. Hey, this is a wonderful idea. You ought to try that sometime. You'll get arrested. But if you're a big bank, you get an award. Depends on who you are. We bailed them out. We bailed out the AIG Corporation. The government simply took it over at the hefty cost of $80 billion. General Motors, the government took over for years. Bailed it out. You paid for all of that. What did you get? Remarkable. You did save the banks. So again, on their behalf, let me thank you. And you saved General Motors. It continues to make the same mediocre cars it did before. And the AIG Corporation limps along, a shadow of its former self, but it's still alive. Here's the people who didn't get bailed out. 5 million people who lost their homes. Too bad, sorry. We couldn't find the money for you. We couldn't save your home, your family, your trauma of going through being evicted, having your stuff thrown out on the sidewalk and having everyone in the neighborhood look at you. Those people we didn't bail out. Wages. Wages in this country have stagnated. For the entire time since the crash, wages have gone nowhere. Profits have gone through the roof. because bailing out the banks with your money got them going again so they could make a lot of money, which they did. And General Motors is having a great year or two. It's wonderful. Thank you again. They got bailed out. You didn't. You didn't. Millions of people lost their jobs. Out of those millions, roughly half have left the labor force. They gave up. They are not now living either off their savings, that doesn't last real long, off their friends and neighbors, that lasts longer, or doing something which the government doesn't keep track of. Let me say that again. Living off something the government doesn't keep track of. One more time. Doing illegal things that they don't want anyone to keep a record of. One of them is ravaging this country. It's called the opioid epidemic. When I went to Kentucky last spring to be the scholar in residence at that university, I talked about capitalism, and they listened very attentively. But when it was over and I said, well, what are you folks excited about? They said, heroin, it's killing us. White people's heroin is killing us. Because in these parts of the country, it's white people who for the first time are experiencing the level of epidemic that has already decimated other communities at other times. The other half of the people who were once unemployed, those who didn't leave the labor force, have come back in the labor force. That's what you hear about. The unemployment rate is down. Here's the detail. The jobs, they're terrible. They're jobs without benefits, they're jobs without security, they're jobs without any hope. The jobs lost had those things. The jobs that replaced them don't. You know what that's called? A decline in the standard of living. Which means the people who went back to work paid the price of a decline in their standard of living. Here's a little story for you. I live in Manhattan. Around the corner from me in Manhattan is a Starbucks. That doesn't make me unique because around the corner in every block in Manhattan is a Starbucks. It looks, tastes, and smells exactly like every other one. That's because Americans are deeply committed to individuality. Right? Think about it. Every Starbucks looks the same, every McDonald's looks the same, every Burger King looks the same, every Pizza Hut, you get it? We are a country of rugged individualists. Heaven forbid someone would make something different. So I'm sitting there having my morning coffee one day, and a young woman, I would guess maybe 20 years old, maybe 21, comes in. She's shy, she's a little nervous. She goes up to the counter where a young black American, African American is making, you know, working there, making coffees. Then he's very sweet to her, and he says, you know, what kind of coffee would you like? And kind of stammering, I'm sitting there, so I overhear it all. She doesn't want a coffee. She would like an application form. She'd like to get a job. And he looks at her with a kind of sweetness, and he says to her, look, do you mind my asking, do you have a bachelor's degree? Do you have a BA degree from college? And her face falls, and she says, no, I'm in college, but I dropped out because I have to make some money, which is why I want to get this job here so I can save up some money and go back and get my college. So he says, look, I'll take your form, but I got to tell you, if you don't have a BA, there's no job for you at Starbucks. No job for her to sweep the place, no job for her to make the coffee, which, as you know, takes an advanced PhD degree to manage. Why does Starbucks do that? Because they can. Because people are so desperate, are having such a hard time, that they can do that and feel good that they have high standards, leaving, of course, this young lady to slink out the door feeling bad about the situation. That's the job recovery we have experienced. The median income in the United States of a family, that means 50% of the families have more than this, 50% or less. The median income of American families is lower today than it was in 2007. What recovery? What are you talking about? And it's 10 years later. For 10 years, the income of those at the top has soared, and for everybody else, nothing except opioids and Trump. Well, that's your reward. That's what you got. That's what the people got. What's going on? It's a system that works like this. That's how this system works. And this system has a name. It's called capitalism. I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes. But before I do, I want to tell you about the other big problem of capitalism, despite or besides the instability, the producing of these crashes in the 30s, now again now, with all of the stories I've just told you. I want to switch your attention for a minute to the next big virtue of capitalism. Hear it, ready? Here it is. It's called inequality. Inequality. Let me drive home to you, if you're not familiar with it, with a couple of statistics. I won't bore you with a lot, just a couple. Economists don't know how to talk without statistics. It's a congenital defect that we have. Okay? The best agency in the world that keeps records of inequality all over the world is called Oxfam. Some of you have heard of it. It's a famous old British institution in England that studies and issues reports. It's been doing it for decades. Very famous. Everybody in the world uses it. So they issue a report every February on world inequality. So let's see. Here's the statistic you can take away. The 68 richest people on the planet, 68. Number one, by the way, Bill Gates. Most of these 68 are Americans. Not all, not by long shot, but most. More are Americans than any other nationality. Although you'll be surprised at how many Chinese people are entering these ranks. But for the moment, it's mostly an American phenomenon. Has names like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and folks like that. Okay, the 68 richest people have together, if you add up the wealth each of them has into one big pile, the 68 richest people have the same, a bit more wealth than the bottom half of the population of this planet. That's 3.5 billion people. Okay, I assume in this room there are people with moral and religious commitments. They fancy themselves good Christians, good whatever. You want... Someday, I need to have explained to me how you square that kind of a commitment with the number I just gave you. 68 people have more wealth than 3.5 billion. And let's remember two things. One, the 3.5 billion are the 3.5, the poor half of the human race. Those are the people who die early of diseases they don't need to die of. Who have bad housing, bad education, bad fill in the blank. They suffer. They suffer a lot because they're poor. And then there are 68 people who have more wealth than they do. Here's something to think about. If we cut the wealth of those 68 in half, they'd still be the 68 richest people in the world. But we would have half their wealth to really make a difference in the lives of 3.5 billion of our fellow human beings. You want to square that with your religion, please? Now let me drive home what it means. I kind of know these numbers are hard. I'm going to stay with Bill Gates. I have nothing against Bill Gates. I've never met Bill Gates. I'm sure he's very nice and pets his dog. I'm sure. If he has a dog. If not, he pets something else. Bill Gates has about $80 billion. And I thought you might be interested in what that means, in case you've never thought about it. Here's what people with that kind of money do. They hire an enterprise or a group of them to manage their money because they don't know how to do it, they're not interested in doing it, and it's boring. The entity they hire in New York City usually is called a hedge fund. That's what it does. It takes the money of very wealthy institutions or people, and it invests it for them. And a typical hedge fund today in New York if it were approached by Bill Gates, would say to him, we'll make you a clean net after taxes and so on, 5%. They would probably offer more, but 5% is easily okay. So let's do the math. 80 billion roughly, 5% works out. I mean, these numbers are rough. I did the arithmetic exactly, so stay with me on this. That works out to, get ready, $82 million a week. That's why Bill Gates does not buy lottery tickets. He doesn't have to. He wins the lottery every week anyway, without buying any tickets. Buying tickets is for people who don't know better, like you and me, who really don't buy them to win anything. We buy them for the few hours of fantasy when we imagine what we might do if we won, which is all we're ever going to get out of buying that ticket. He doesn't need a ticket, does he? $82 million a week. What in the world is going on? That is the fruit of the capitalist system. This is a system that produces that kind of wealth concentrated in a tiny number of people. You know where you have to go in history to get back to this kind of a level? The ancient pharaohs of Egypt. That's how much progress we've made in the intervening thousands of years. We wended our way back to that level of inequality. You know, some king embalmed in a tomb that was built by 80,000 slaves slugging bricks and stones up them. We can visit the pyramids to see what's left. What kind of an economic system is this? Why do we permit this? That's what capitalism delivers us, instability and inequality. What are we doing? Either the instability or the inequality alone should make us question this system. The two together, that's a slam dunk. We ought to be able, as a nation, to ask and answer the question, can't we do better than capitalism? We can't do better than this. Of course we can. Before I tell you how I think we're going to do it, let me tell you how some Americans you might not know about tried. So you don't think we're the first ones to come up with this idea or the first ones to try. And if what I'm about to tell you, you were not aware of, like, for example, you might not have been aware of what Bill Gates is doing, earning $82 million a week. Of course he's a billionaire. What the hell is he going to do with all of that? How many mansions do you want to buy? 420 yachts every 15 feet? What? So he just accumulates it, and it gets more and more and more. It's like a lunatic. The system makes lunatics out of us. Well, here's an example of somebody who said something has to be done. His name is Franklin Roosevelt. President of the United States, the most popular president we ever had, was reelected four times. Elected four times, reelected three times. The only president. So frightened were the Republicans by the endless reelection of Mr. Roosevelt that they passed a law when he died to make nobody have more than two terms, which is why we have that law. No other president got anywhere close to such a record. In 1944, he's president at the time, Mr. Roosevelt sends his State of the Union message early in the year to the Congress, saying, I'd like you to pass the following legislation, which is what State of the Union messages usually do. He said, I would like to have an income tax whose top rate is 100%. Let me explain to you what this means. Every dollar that an American gets, this is the president. Message to Congress. Every dollar that an American gets over $25,000 a year, the government will tax them at the rate of 100%, which means every dollar over the $25,000 you earn, you don't get any of it. The government gets it and uses it to help the mass of people. In today's money, it would be about $400,000 a year. That's what you can get. After that, no more. You're done. You'll just have to struggle with that. He sent this message to the Congress I hope you'll be surprised when I tell you that the Republicans went ballistic. That's when they learned that skill. They've honed it ever since. They went ballistic. And when the dust cleared and the Democrats gave their boring speeches and Republicans repeated theirs, a compromise was reached, which your president signed. The law of the United States was every dollar over $25,000 that an American gets, he keeps, ready? 6 cents. The other 94 cents went to Washington. Is this what happened in a communist country? No. Our country. Not ancient history. And if you never knew that, then that tells you something about your education. Doesn't it? Wow. There was an attempt to do something. An attempt to do something. Wow. Do you know what the income tax rate on corporations was under Roosevelt? Went up sky high, 60, 50, 70%. He taxed rich people. He taxed corporations. And guess what he did with it? He used it to create the Social Security system. We never had that before. How many of you don't know that? In the depths of the Depression, when the government had absolutely no money because millions of people were unemployed and not paying any taxes, and millions of businesses had gone out of business, they weren't paying any taxes, the government had no money, and it said, as of tomorrow, I'm going to give everybody who's 65 years of age or older a check for the rest of their life. No money, and he could do it. It's like the opposite of Kansas. With a lot of money, they don't do anything. Right? I don't mean pick out anybody, you know, with a brown back or anything like that. But,
thank you.
You know, so, but in that moment, Mr. Roosevelt said, you know, he got on a kind of a tear. And after he created unemployment, after he created the Social Security, he created the unemployment system. We never had that before either, folks. There was no federal unemployment insurance. He said, I am going to give every unemployed worker a check every week for years to help them through a hard time. A government that had no money. And then the best part, if the private sector either cannot or will not provide work for the millions of Americans who are out of work and want a job, well then, said Mr. Roosevelt, I will. It's my job. If the private sector, I'll do it. And between 34 and 41, he created and filled about 15 million jobs. Producing, by the way, little details like the national parks that some of you enjoy visiting. The first ecological reclamation projects of the agricultural adjustment business that was passed. Wonderful. For you that don't know it, the WPA. How many of you know a little bit about that? All over the United States, unemployed artists and sculptors and singers and people with any kind of artistic or craft skill were told, if you're unemployment, come here, the government will hire you. And put together teams of people who would then be sent all over the country to little towns and villages who had no cultural programs that they could afford. They would now be visited by a troop of professionals who had been hired by the government. It was the greatest distribution of cultural assets to the American people we've ever had. We never had anything like it before, and we have nothing like it since, unless you want to count television. Wow, what a creative thing. And how did the government pay for Social Security, unemployment compensation, and 15 million people who had a job and therefore income and therefore could make their mortgage payment and keep their house? The government had no money. You know how Roosevelt got the money? He went to the rich people and he said, you're going to give it to me. I'm going to charge you taxes up the wazoo, and you're going to give it to me. And here's why you're going to give it to me. Because if you don't, the trade union movement and the Communist Party and the Socialist Party are going to take your wealth away from you. So you better give me a part of it, because that's the price of not losing all of it. And Mr. Roosevelt said, could you say that again? And they repeated it to him. And for those of you who don't know, in the 1930s and 40s, there was a very powerful alliance of the union movement and the communists and the socialists. Big one, very successful. The unions organized something called the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the most successful union organizing drive in the history of the United States. Again, we never had anything like it before. We've never had anything like it since. And that was helped by the communists and the socialists, two socialist parties, one communist party that worked closely with the labor unions and did all of that, including big things here in St. Louis and Kansas City, as in all American basic cities. Part of our history. And if you don't know about it, you got a problem with how our history is taught to us, or rather, not taught to us. Was Mr. Roosevelt able to tax them? Did they prevent him? Did it cost Mr. Roosevelt his career the way a politician today would say, oh, I'd love to do that, but I would never survive. He's the most successful president in American history. Let me repeat that. The president who taxed the rich to help everybody else wins the prize as the most successful president. You kind of wonder, just for a minute, why Mr. Obama didn't try that. Who knows? And at the end of the war, again for your history, at the end of the war, the right wing, the corporations, who were horrified by what they had been taxed, and the rich who were horrified by what they had been taxed, they knew they had to undo this. And at the end of the war was now over. The president died about the same time. And now it's late 1945 and 46, and the right wing says, our problem wasn't Roosevelt. He would never have done this. He's a son of a good American family with another president a while ago. He did that because he was pressured by the unions and the communists and the and he was right. So they reached a strategy which the right won. Our problem isn't the Roosevelt and it isn't the Democrats. Sorry, forgot to do this. I always forget this.
But he's reading.
We have to get rid of those people. We have to get rid of the communists and the socialists and the unions. And they went to work to do that. It began by picking the weakest link in that alliance, and that was the communists. They had to be re-described to the American people. They weren't the militants who helped build that union movement. They were agents of a foreign, scary power. The communists, the Russians, blah, 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 all that. And we crushed them very effectively. Then we went around, the government did this with help of private enterprise. We went around America and we taught the American people that, you know, the socialists, they're really like the communists. They just spell it differently. But I'm serious. All my life, when I teach in the university and I begin to explain socialism and communism, I used to discover this enormously weird thing that for my students, communist, socialist, Marxist, anarchist, it's all the same. It's just spelled differently. If you go to any European country, people understand the difference between them as like the difference between green and blue, or yellow and white, or Monday and Friday. But Americans don't. At first I thought Americans are stupid. Not at all. That was our history. We destroyed that. We made Americans think that if a left-wing effort is made to get you to go to a meeting or to do something, you should back away. It's gonna cost you. We are still humbled by that. That's why Americans who believe the way so many of us don't do anything, because we're scared. We don't admit it, we don't understand. It comes from that period of history and it has sunk real deep into the American psyche. That's our history, folks. And because we got rid of the left, we live in a capitalism whose instability and inequality are an affront to what we believe in, to our morality, to our religious commitments, and to the safety of our own lives and our future. And even that we could have tolerated, except one more thing. one more thing. In the 1970s, American capitalists, feeling quite powerful, they had destroyed the communists, destroyed the socialists, and the labor movement has been, as you, I assume you all know, on a 50-year decline, losing members and influence every year for 50 years. That's the truth. So none of it's there. So the capitalists in 1970 decided to do something to make a lot more money. You're living with that. Here we go. One, they looked around the United States and said, you know, we've had a 100-year struggle with American workers. And over that time, because of unions, they've pushed up the wages. And American workers get paid pretty well, 1970s. But we don't have to do that anymore. With modern jet travel and with the internet, we can produce in China, in Brazil, in India. What are we paying high wages here for? We can produce there. The minimum wage in Bangladesh today for a garment worker, ready? $50 a month. That's by the way, why your underpants are the price they are. Well, it is. So capitalists began to leave. They're going to go where they can make more money. That's it. The second thing they discovered was a way to make more money was to bring, ready, cheap workers here. If it didn't work to put the factory out there, bring them here and pay them nothing. Preferably if they don't have documents, because then they're scared to death and they have to accept anything you do because they can't go to the police to complain. Bring them in, quick. And the third thing, now that the unions are broken, automate. Develop the computer, develop the robots. So the American working class, living in a capitalism that subjects them to instability and inequality, had another whack in the face. Job loss, because the companies leave. Wage pressure downward, immigrants coming in that are desperate and needy, and being replaced by automation. It's too much. And as a result, your wages go nowhere. And as a result, your organizations are weak. Why are American working class people loyal to a system that has treated them this way? It makes no sense. You don't need to be an ideologue. You explain this, I explain this to the American people, and they get it. No problem at all. What remains in the final part of what I have to tell you, what remains in my audiences, huge and multiple as they are, I've only given you a smattering of what I've been doing. The big question is, what can we do? What can we do about all this? How do you solve? Where do you even begin? So let me answer. There's something common to all of these things. That is the problem we can solve. Who makes the decision, for example, to replace a worker with a machine, to move a factory from St. Louis to Shanghai, to take the bulk of the profits made by a group of workers and give them to a tiny number of people to create incredible wealth? Who makes these decisions and many more? There's a very simple answer. It's called the board of directors and the major shareholders of every corporation. That's who makes the decision. Let me remind you, for those of you not familiar, with how a capitalist business works. Most of you and I in this room, we go to work for a corporation of one kind or another. We are the employees. We come at 9 in the morning or whenever it is. We leave at 5. We do our job. We have our lunch in a big hurry. We go to the bathroom twice. You know. 5 out of 7 days, and each night we go home, and we're really thrilled about it. You know how we know we're thrilled about it? Because on the way home, we stop at a place which offers us a happy hour. Helping us to remember, in case we forgot, what was the different quality of the preceding 8 hours. For which we need that offset. And we stop and we lubricate, and then we go the rest of the way home. We do what we're told, don't we? We cross that threshold, and the boss says, sit there, work with that machine in that way. And when you're done using your brains and your muscles to produce whatever that company makes, your job is to get out of there. Get your coat and get out. You know what you produced? That's ours. That stays here. And if by mistake a stapler is in your pocketbook, you will lose your job, which you know, which is why you put the stapler elsewhere. Right? No one in this room, but other people do that, right? Who tells you where to sit? The board of directors. You know how the board of directors works? Every corporation has a board. It's the law. Every corporation has a board of directors. Typically 12 to 20 people. That's all. Very small. You know how you get to be on the board of directors? You have to be elected by the shareholders. That's how it's done. Every year, shareholders elect the board of directors. If you're not aware of that, that's because you're not one of them. Which may come as a shock, and I'm sorry to bring you this news, but you're not. And I can see from some of your faces, you just made a decision you're aiming at that. You hope to get to be that. Good luck to you. Here's how it works. Every share is one vote. So if you own no shares, that's how many votes you got. Zilch. Most workers in most factories have no shares. So they have no influence at all. Same in the office, same in the store. If you own 1 million shares, you get, ready, 1 million votes. Turns out that 1% of shareholders in America, 1% of shareholders, own about 2/3 of the shares. In other words, that's the 1% that the Occupy people helped us understand. The 1% who decide who's on the board of directors. Here's what the board of directors decides. What the company produces, how the company produces, where the company produces, and here comes the good one, what to do with the profits that the company makes. That's how a company works. So let's review. The decision makers are the board of directors, 12 to 20 people. The major shareholders, 12 to 20 people, 24 people. How many folks work at General Motors? 100,000. Whoops. 100,000 people take orders. 100,000 people live with the results of decisions over which they have no authority whatsoever. A capitalist corporation is an anti-democratic institution, isn't it?
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Trump's Economic Strategy and What to Do About It, part one of a three-part series with economist Richard Wolff. This program was recorded on Friday, March 24th, at the Carpenters Regional Council here in Kansas City, Missouri. The forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived forum podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week at 6 p.m. for another forum presentation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.